One, two, three.
Dear friends, look around now. Choose the nearest exit to your seat. And in case of disturbance of any kind, to avoid the dangers of panic, walk, do not run, to that exit. And now, we ask you all to shift on your sanitary pedestals and join us in that great old hymn, By Order of PD.
Go indeed. This is Eric Nelson, and you're listening to a very special two-hour deep dive into the wondrous world of the Firesign Theater. This is not What a Week This Week, but this is weirdly a very political show. If you project the politics back about 50 years and you project them forward to the present day, and you project it forward into the future, because that's the temporal space the Firesign Theater managed to occupy. They spoke to the past, they spoke to the present, they spoke to their present, their future, our present, et cetera, et cetera. Joining me, we'll see if everything works, Jeremy Braddock, are you there? Jeremy? So one guest down, but we will get him, we'll summon him up in just a second. Phil Proctor, are you there?
Ooh, can you hear me now, Eric?
I do. That would be Jeremy. Okay. That would be...
Yes.
I've got you now. It would not be a live radio without a couple of glitches. And we're trying to dial in, and we're going to get him in just a second because we know he's standing by, the great Phil Proctor of the Firesign Theater. But while I've got you, Jeremy, we're here because of your book. You wrote this incredible book. I'm going to give the title now, which does justice to the book. Firesign, the electromagnetic history of everything as told on 9 comedy albums. It's a great title, well worthy of the Firesign Theater. And I was so knocked out by it that I basically, I got a hold of you immediately and said, we got to do something on the radio. And here we are today. I just want to see, Phil Proctor, are you there now?
Yes, I am. I just heard myself in an echo, too.
Well, I was just giving the history of this wondrous particular show, where I didn't anticipate that you'd be joining us, but here you are. And we talk about the multidimensional nature of what we're doing. We're talking about the recorded works of the Firesign Theater. We're talking about an analytical book on the Firesign Theater by an authentic Cornell professor, which is you, Jeremy Braddock, and one of the artists and creators of the Firesign Theater is joining us too to ping pong back, hopefully in a fascinating, worthy of the Firesign Theater ping pong effect. So I'm going to throw the first question to you, Phil.
Sure.
55 years ago, maybe, was there, wherever, when you guys started this up, with the idea that 50, 60 years later, that there'd be academic works on the Firesign Theater, where people are deep diving and finding the work of the Firesign Theater so unbelievably relevant, did that ever cross your minds at that point in time?
Sure. No, I'll tell you, the fact is that I joined the group quite by chance. And all of this, by the way, is gone into more detail in a book that I co-authored with my late friend, called Where's My Fortune Cookie?
A great book. And yes, I was going to give you a major plug, but do go on. We're going to be coming back to that book.
You can plug it later. People have very short-term memory.
We'll do it at least 20 times in the next 2 hours. But do go on, Phil.
So anyway, through a very strange series of events that involved Peter Fonda, and Brandon DeWilda, I ended up reconnecting with Peter Bergman, who was an acquaintance from Yale, because he wrote the lyrics for two musicals that I starred in the Dramat at Yale, written by Austin Pendleton, Tom Jones, and Booth Is Back in Town, in which I played Edwin Booth. Peter Bergman wrote the lyrics, co-authored them in one case, and wrote the lyrics for Booth Is Back in Town. So I had worked with him professionally in the theater. And I was at the, I don't know if I should tell the whole crazy story, but Peter Fonda was doing research for his little movie, which was then called Captain America, but Marvel wouldn't give him the rights to the name. So it became known as, let me think, Easy Rider, which, by the way, means a person who lives off the earnings of a prostitute, not a pimp, but a boyfriend.
Thank you for sharing that point.
All right. So anyway, he's out doing research for the movie, and we went to the Sunset Strip where there was going to be a protest on about a curfew that they wanted to impose on the Strip, because too many hippies and anti-war protesters and openly sexual people and pot-smoking people were causing great disturbances to the psyche of America. And so we went out to join this protest. And at one point, I sat down in an open issue of the LA Free Press, which was the radical press at the time, liberal press. I sat on a picture of Peter Bergman. So I'm sitting on Peter Bergman's face. I pulled it out from under me. It says, KPFK newsman Peter Bergman interviews returning Vietnam War veterans. I went, oh, he's a KPFK. So the rest of the evening progresses. Peter gets beaten up. Brandon gets arrested. I was writing for the East Village Other. I was their West Coast correspondent at the time. So I held up my press card, which had a big eye on it. That scared the police, and they just walked, you know.
And the Buffalo Springfield wrote For What It's Worth. They wrote Something's Happening Here about that riot, correct?
That's exactly what it was about. That's right. What it was wasn't exactly clear, but it was to me. Anyway, the next day I called up Peter Bergman. He said, yeah, I'm the Wizard of Oz. I thought, well, he's gone. He said, no, I do a show called Radio Free Oz on KPFK every evening. And why don't you come down and play with us? I said, great. So I go down. I meet these two other guys, David Osman and Phil Austin, who are associated with the show. And we discover that we're all fire signs. I'm a Leo. Peter's a Sagittarian. Dave's a Sagittarian. And Austin, unfortunately, is an Aries. So Bergman names us right there on the spot, the Fire Sign Theater. And we started improvising together that very night on the radio live. And that was the birth of the Fireside Theater. And Bergman always said, we're going to become the Beatles of comedy. Okay? Well, he had a vision.
And he was pretty correct. Interesting. There's an article that came out, actually a review. I'm going to run this by you, Phil, and okay. Please react accordingly. Somebody reviewed Jeremy's new book and talked about the overlap with the Beatles. And he broke down the Fire Sign Theater as Beatle members. So strap in here.
Yeah.
To his mind, Peter Bergman was Paul because he was not technically the founder, but he became their mastermind. David Osmond was John, the group's poet in more than a figurative sense. Phil Austin would naturally be George, albeit without the spiritual beliefs. There's only one Beatle left. Guess who you are?
Oh, my gosh. I'm Ringo?
You're Ringo.
I didn't know that. Oh, that's really frightening.
Yeah, they say, well, but this is an interesting connection. They say because you were the only established professional actor among the fire signs, in the same way that Ringo was an established professional musician before joining the Beatles. So it isn't just because your large nose and winsome looks. I think it's because of the fact that you And your book, by the way, and I'm going to bounce back to Jeremy in just a second, but we may be name-checking, and these are some of the names that pop up in your book. Let me just go through this in no particular order. Jacques Tati, The Goons,
yes.
Phil Hartman, yes. Steve Jobs, Graham Parsons, Rush Limbaugh, Marshall McLuhan, yeah. Charles Manson, Steve Martin, and Bob Marley. You got a few name checks there. I'm not sure you and Charles Manson hung out, but I know you had a direct connection. We may uncover some of those stories. And I have to say, folks, that we do have a sponsor, even though this is a non-commercial radio station. It's Jack Poet Volkswagen.
Wasn't that a 114-millimeter recoilless howitzer, Bob?
Yes, it was, Jim. And so far, the Army has stuck to their traditional ground attack.
Yeah, they're relying on those big guns on the flanks.
Ah, wait a minute, Bob. The Navy is going to the air. A perfect pass, Jim. Ah, there's the shot signaling the end of the first half of this Army-Navy classic.
And so the score at halftime here at Pueblo Field is 32-20 with 12 missing.
Good afternoon, snort fans. It's timeout down on the field and time to stop taking it on the chin. You know that when the traffic gets really hairy and that 5 o'clock shadow falls across your car, there's only one way to save face. In a Jack Poet Volkswagen. So for a close shave, drive the freeways, but for true peace of mind and a razor-sharp deal, see the nice folks at Jack Poet Volkswagen, 5944 North Figueroa in Highland Park.
Jack Poet, if you need some wheels, Jack Poet, he makes better deals. Jack Poet, he's the best by far. You're a poet in your poet car.
Hmm. Okay.
Yes.
We're going to be hearing a number of those annoying commercials. I don't know who made them, but we have a sponsor. We have to fulfill them. Jeremy, a question for you. Let's get to your wonderful book, which is what brought us here. What inspired you to dedicate how many years of your life?
Well, I guess that depends on how you count. I think I've wanted to write this book for, well, since I was in my 20s. In fact, I met all of the fire signs once in the 90s. But when I decided to really go for it and actually try to write it was about 8 or 9 years ago. So the better part of a decade writing and researching.
And what inspired this compulsion? What is it in the work of the Fire Sign Theater that brought you? Everyone has different reasons. Phil Proctor, we know you're imperative to join and hook up with these guys and create this art. I can talk about my interest in it, but I'm much more interested, Jeremy, in what gives. You know, why are we still talking about these guys?
Well, I guess I would say, you know, personally, I grew up listening to the record, so I'm not of Fire Sign generation, but I had an uncle who was, and he started giving me the records when I was, you know, maybe 12 or 13, so I really came of age listening to the records, and, you know, found them really funny, but I think even then, you know, understood that they were actually really deep also, and there was a lot to understand and a lot to know about the records, I think that's the short answer, but I also think that I'm super fascinated in how the records sound. So I think that Fire Sign had a long career, but especially in the Columbia years, which were like 1967 to 1975, they're recording at state-of-the-art studios and also recording technology and practices change a huge amount over that period of time. So it seemed to me that writing a book would allow me to sort of tell that story in as sort of secondary level. And I also think that they are really unique and in a sense really major thinkers about media institutions and media technology. So I thought that if I did it right, I could write a book that hopefully would ring true to the group themselves and to the fans from the period, but also interest people from my generation who might not yet have heard Fire Sign and certainly were not as obsessive fans as I have always been.
Phil, the question that one of the many questions I have, it's a question one will always ask about great artists, is how the art got that way. And we'll talk about the recording techniques. But from a very simple question is the writing process, how the hive mind worked, how four or five crazy guys could come up with material of this density that was written in one voice, performed in a kaleidoscope of voices, but all is instantly recognizable of the Firesign Theater. You invented your own language as a English major type language, let alone the recording thing. How did you create the magic? But was there a process, or did your writing?
Yeah.
How did that go?
Yeah. First of all, I want to mention that the parallel to Ringo also does apply to me, because I supplied a lot of comic rhythm to the work that we did. And also, I am a singer and a musician. I play the violin, or I did back in the day. And I like Phil Austin, brought an aspect of music to the group. And music and comedy are very much allied. You know, comic rhythms. They always say, what's the secret to good comedy? Timing, okay? So, anyway, we started by improvising on the radio together, all right? So we were writing on the spot, and we were playing off of one another and creating characters and letting those characters speak in a comedic manner and bounce off of one another, because all of us would be assuming different characters. So already we were starting to create a cast of thousands in our approach to comedy. And we did live radio, not just on Radio Free Oz, but then afterwards on many other stations, a lot of kind of FM or listener-supported stations, and even a commercial station, KRLA. We would have been on there a lot. Oh, yeah. And when we were on KRLA, there was another group of zanies who appeared after us making parodies of the news called The Credibility Gap, with our friend Harry Shearer and
Michael
David
McKeon,
Lander,
the core.
Michael McKeon.
You knew them
right?
Before they were Spinal Tap. I'm very impressed.
Yeah, well, I knew me before I was Fireside Theater. So, you know, there you go. But that was basically, so we became used to interacting and writing on the spot together. And then what we'd also do is we would bring in pieces of our own original writing, because suddenly we had a place to perform it in, you know. And I'd always been interested in writing comedy. My great influences as I grew up were Bob and Ray on the radio and Ernie Kovacs on the television, okay? Both really surrealists in their own way. And then, tangentially, the Goon Shows, which were absolutely surrealist comedians.
And huge influences, right? To the Beatles, too. So there's one, another one.
Because they used sound effects and music in very strange and wonderful ways to augment their zany stories, okay, and their incredible characters, with people like Peter Sellers and Harry Secom and the great Spike Milligan, okay, whom Peter got to work with.
That's what I was going to say. Peter, actually, the torch was passed literally from Spike to Peter in England, correct?
Yeah, did you know that, Jeremy, by the way?
Yep, it is in the book.
Good. Being part of the history, such a long history, over half a century, of working with various combinations. Uh-oh, am I still there?
Yep, you're still here.
Uh-oh, I think I may have been lost. Oh, dear.
We can hear you, Phil.
If you can't hear me, you're going to have to call me back.
I can hear you.
All right, I'm hanging up now.
Oh, boy. Okay, well, what we're going to do while we get Phil back, we're talking about the fire, so why don't we play some Firesign Theater. Do you have anything you'd want to hear, Jeremy?
Well, I was hoping, if we can get Phil back, I prepared a couple of clips of them improvising, and I'd love for him to hear it and respond.
Well, why don't we play a piece that this is before the first record. This was at the Magic Mushroom on Magic Mushroom Club and Ventura Boulevard. So this is in the before they cut Waiting for the Electrician, but it's a short in front of a live audience, but I think it demonstrates the their process here. And we come back, we will absolutely have Phil Proctor back on the line.
Great.
11, 10, 9, 7, 5, 3,
sound.
1, start.
Murphy Classroom Films presents Educational Film B-151, Exorcism and Your Daily Life.
Gee, Dad, what a bummer.
Why, what's the matter, Jimmy?
My civics teacher assigned me this dumb paper on exorcism, and I'm supposed to go play ring ball with Bruce. I mean, what does exorcism have to do with me and ring ball and Bruce?
More than you can ever imagine. I used to feel the same way you do about exorcism, Billy, but your mom and I learned long before you were born the real importance that it has in all our lives.
But I don't even understand what it means, Dad.
Oh, well, in a manner of speaking, Willie, exorcism is a transitive verb meaning to expel an evil spirit from or out of a person or place by invocation or use of holy names. It's akin to the Greek herkos, a fence, with its cognate horkos, an oath, whence hokazine, to bind with an oath, thence exorcizare, that's Low Latin.
Gee, Dad, I still don't understand.
Oh. Well, Timmy, let's go see my old friend Bob Brown at the bank.
Again?
Good morning, Bob.
Morning, Bob. Morning, Tommy.
Hi, Mr. Brown.
Well, how have you been since you were here this morning asking about capillary action?
Fine, Mr. Brown.
Good, good. Well, what is it now? Wheat production in the Great Northwest?
No.
The gross national product of Sweden?
Golly, that's close.
Our animal friends?
Cold.
Exorcism?
Yes, I have to write this dumb paper.
Now, hold on. Hold on, son, you wouldn't call it dumb. If you knew about exorcism, what my old friend Mayor Simmons knows about exorcism. Why don't you go and see him?
Good morning, Mayor Simmons.
Morning, Bob. Morning, Freddy. Well, what is it this time? The Australian ballot? Representative government in post-war Indochina? The cultivation of sea kelp? Our internal waterways?
No. Exorcism, Mr. Mayor.
Now, Billy, I can tell you this. If it weren't for exorcism, Murleyville wouldn't be the town it is today. Take a look at this graph.
Oh, that's very interesting, Mr. Mayor, but I already know about the pancreas.
Oh, well then, take a look at this other graph.
It's shaped like a pie.
Have a piece, Sammy. Now, that piece of pie is equal to the 14% of the Murleyville town budget that goes for exorcism. Sounds like a lot, doesn't it?
It sure does. As a matter of fact, I've been meaning to talk to you about it.
Well, if it sounds like a lot now, haha, just remember the trouble we had when I first proposed it at the town meeting.
Gentlemen, 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 gentlemen.
Get him!
Gentlemen, citizens of Murleyville.
Mr. Mayor?
Yes, Miss Cratch.
How can you expect the citizens of Murleyville, already bled white by your corrupt machine, to spend another 14% of our pie on exorcism? Whatever that is.
That's right. Tell him, Miss Cratch.
Miss Cratch, as our civics teacher, you of all people should realize the importance of exorcism in this efficient and democratic working model township.
That's all very well, Mr. Mayor, but aren't we here to talk about the corn smut that's ruining our crops?
Grubble, corn smut,
exactly,
grubble.
Exactly, Ollie.
Grubble.
Take a look at this working model.
But we already know about the refining of petroleum byproducts.
Shh, exactly, Miss Cratch. Let me turn the working model on. Now, as you can see, these little red trucks here with the 2.5 men on the side drive up with their 118% of 1964 capacity oil loads and deposit them in those 5.5 black buckets, which are then lifted to the 75% over parity mark through these little broken lines, ending finally in John's gas station as fuel for our cars and farm machinery, at the lignite mine as kerosene to light the lamps of the workers, to Mr. Foster's cola factory as artificial coloring, and the rest is exported abroad by Mr. Artunian to make nylon stockings.
Then there's none left for insecticide.
Exactly, Ollie.
And that's why we got a corn smut epidemic.
Yeah, we'll peach him.
Awesome.
And that's how it all happened, Frankie.
Gee, Mr. Mayor, I sure see how exorcism ties into oil refining, but I still don't think I have enough for my dumb civics paper. I mean, how does it all fit into our American way of life?
What Ronnie means, Mayor, is how does it all fit into our American way of life?
I might be able to fill you in on that. I've got a working model working over here somewhere. But actually, you'd probably do better to talk to my friend Bob Brown down at the bank.
Again?
Well, actually, Mayor Tweed, we just came from Bob's office, and,
Who else is open at this time of night? You might try kindly old Dr. Phillith down at the Armenian Medical Association.
Now, just soak it 12 times a day and keep off your side as much as possible. I'll give you a subscription for petroleum jelly. Oh, hello, Kenny and your dad. What's troubling you? You don't look at all well. Want an upper?
No, Doc. No. No, my teeth are fine. It's Lenny here. He's got to write a dumb civics paper on exorcism, and Mayor Simmons suggested that we visit you.
Well,
you know.
Fine. You just take off your shirt and sit over there. I'll turn the lights out, and now, this first slide is the gestation of the frog.
Gee!
No, Doc. What Mickey wanted to learn about this week was something entirely...
This is one of the many great impressionist cathedrals.
No, exorcism, Doc.
Oh. Well, why didn't you say so? Let me just set up this audio-visual projector. Yeah, here we go.
11, 10, 9, 7, 5, 3...
Sound.
1.
Start.
Herpy Classroom Films presents educational film B-152, Ring Ball and Your Daily Life.
Dad, what a bummer.
Why, what's the matter, Jimmy?
My civics teacher assigned me this dumb paper on ring ball, and I'm supposed to go exercise a Dybbuk with Bruce. I mean, what does ring ball have to do with me? Or exorcism? Or Bruce?
More than you can ever imagine. I used to feel the same way you do about ring ball, Harold, but...
Well, that was... Speaking of temporal displacement, Phil Proctor, are you back with us?
At once when I'm not anywhere at all. And what I wanted to say was that that Ernie Kovacs, Bob and Ray, and the Goon Shows, they all played with the media form, okay? Ernie was, you know, he went just crazy with television. Bob and Ray created the idea, the illusion that they were talking to normal people in interview situations. And, of course, it was completely surreal and crazy, written by a fellow named Ed Koch, by the way, most of their material. And, of course, the Goon Shows used the medium of radio during the war years in England to basically lighten the load on the people, you know, the psychic load on the people who were going through the horrors of Nazism and all the rest.
Well, World War II played a huge influenced your work. World War II, FDR, the references to old-time radio, you
yes.
kind of bridged Norman Corwin from the late 40s, Private Eye, we all know who that was, from Private Eye shows on the radio,
yeah,
to the stoner present, and here we are today. You know, I mean...
it's very true. I mean, the one thing that the four of us had in common was growing... We were radio kids. We grew up listening to the radio, okay? And that was the fulcrum around which our work revolved, because you know we all had in common a media form that we could parody together. Okay, and then of course as television came in, we began Don't Crush That Dwarf, Hand Me the Pliers, our second really, probably our third album, which was our greatest success after Nick Danger. That was a parody of television. And we basically we invented the idea of channel surfing, of going from one place, click, hello, Johnny, I'll click back to another place just by the little click of a remote control.
You're scaring me with technical problems, being that we just had one, and my voice basically looped over your Magic Mushroom Club appearance from 2024, and now we're having you do live channel surfing, as I said at the top of this show. And this would be a special 1 hour and a half to go salute to the Firesign Theater with Jeremy Braddock, author of a fantastic new book on the Firesign Theater called Firesign, The Electromagnetic History of Everything, as told on nine comedy albums, and the great Phil Proctor of the Firesign Theater. And Phil has his book, too, Where's My Fortune Cookie?
Which That's is, right, and I also do a radio show on KPFK, a listener-supported station here in Los Angeles, where the Firesign Theater began.
Well, that is amazing to me. It's such a great show, and the fact is you're still making radio alive at the station where you started up in 1966.
I know. It's wonderful. It's wonderful and amazing.
Phil, can I ask you some questions about radio?
Sure.
So, you were talking about growing up on radio, and I'm wondering, so the place where you recorded your first several albums for Columbia was Columbia Square in Hollywood, which was built for radio in 1938, right?
That's right.
And I know that you discovered a lot of the ribbon mics and a lot of the Foley gear, but also I understand that at KPFK, David Osman and then Phil Austin after him were the literature and drama directors, so there was radio drama being done at KPFK, even after the Golden Age era. So I'm wondering if you want to talk about it. In fact, I know that you guys performed what was one of the very first performances of MacBird early on. So so I wonder if you want to talk about the place of radio drama at KPFK, like in the 60s, and then what it meant to get to Columbia Square and discover that you were working in this super historic location.
Yeah, that also was tremendously exciting. I do want to mention the name of the show. It's Phil and Ted's Sexy Boomer Show. And if you go to sexyboomershow.com, you can hear some of our live interviews and our podcast interviews during COVID. Anyway, yes, radio has been such an extraordinary part of my life. I'm still doing various radio programs. There's a strange one called Adventures in Odyssey, and I just recorded a recurring character. I am Detective Don Polehouse of Odyssey. And it's a radio show, and it's played internationally, and it's been on the air for, like, I don't know, 30 years or something like that. So radio still does continue, astonishingly. And yes, we actually recorded in some of the original radio studios, you know, with the original radio the technicians, you know, were on the other side of the glass, right? And we're working in a studio which might have done Fibber McGee and Molly, God knows what. And in the large studio, it used to be, that was like their auditorium studio where they do Bob Hope and things like that. And we were able to record in there, which gave us the opportunity to create distance. You know, we could really, instead, radio is very much like standing in front of a microphone and with a bunch of other people in a small studio space with earphones on, playing off of one another and counting on the technicians to basically create the ambiance, the place that we were in, or the sound effects, or the gunshots, or the footsteps, or whatever. But basically, the actors were really responsible for, you know, being, creating the illusion of being in that place, in character. But Fire Sign Theater, we were able, during our extraordinary opportunity to record a series of complex, multi-layered albums, we were able to utilize space in different ways to create the effects that we wanted, you know? So we expanded the art of radio acting into other levels. Now, Jeremy has written this extraordinary book, extraordinary study, and since it is from a technological perspective, the one thing I can say is that when we started, and this is all in Jeremy's book, we were recording on four-track tape. So you can imagine trying to create all of these multi-layered experiences on four different tracks. We had to kind of invent ways to make that work. As we continued to work in the medium, the tracks expanded to, like, you know, maybe 40 tracks and then 100 tracks, which meant that the reels of tape got bigger and bigger. And so we were beginning to feel like we were shrinking and that the technology was growing larger around us. And then all of a sudden, when things went digital, it all went away. There was the studio was a little box that you could hold in your hand and you could go anywhere you wanted to record. And we worked with a great engineer, Fred Jones, who had his own wonderful studio in Hollywood. And we would experiment with contact microphones. We'd move from one set to another set to create the illusion of time and space. We'd go down on the street with our little box, our little studio, and record in a car or, you know, in an alley and getting natural sounds. And so we were able to change with the evolution of the media of recording itself. And as Jeremy pointed out in one of the segments in the book, there was a time when we wanted to create thunder. I think it was for Bozos. Yeah, up against the wall of science. And so I went up to the echo chamber in the old Columbia Studios, which was a series of, gosh, I'm not technologically very, very well versed, but it was a series of repeaters of some sort that could create an echo effect. And I would bang on them, and that created electronic thunder. Again, we were like Ernie Kovacs in you know, experimenting with early television. We played with the toys that we were given. We were definitely kids in the sandbox. And he mentioned also, Eric mentioned that he was playing the Exorcism from Our Daily Life from a live performance at the Ash Grove, which was a club that later became the comedy club, a famous comedy club, the improv for years. And so, like the Marx Brothers, we used to go into a cabaret situation, a theater situation, and try out our material, okay? And when we did it on the radio, we had a fellow named Earl Jive, who was our engineer, our live engineer, and he would, you know, drop in the sound effects and the music and other and Foley and things to, you know, augment our improvisations or the material that we were trying out on the radio. But he would also sometimes just drop in his own abstract choices, like a musical choice or a sound effects choice, to which we would have to improvise.
I'm really, if I can jump in, Phil, I was hoping before we lost you to play a piece from the Dear Friends show that I think is, I mean, found in a magazine of some kind, and you guys are sort of performing it blind, but Earl Jive is also sort of inciting you with his records. And Eric, would you play the piece?
We're ready to roll. One more time is station ID. You're listening to KSQD Santa Cruz, KSQT Prunedale. This is a special deep dive into the Firesign Theater with Jeremy Braddock, author of a fantastic new book on the Firesign, Phil Proctor, a.k.a. Ringo. One of the Firesign Theaters helping us annotate his very own work. And
Octopus Garden.
Yeah, Octopus is Garden. It was a great song, Ringo. Anyway, we're going to play that track right now. So let's just settle back and listen to the fabulous Firesign Theater.
No, they don't bite. And then, as you know, chinchillas are mutated chinchillas like these, blue mutants, we call them.
Is that because of their peculiar coloration, Brad, that makes them so rare?
No. They were first crossbred or introduced, as we say, by Alistair Blue, a mutations expert who's been into the raising of these little sweethearts. Careful there.
Is he getting away?
That's all right. We get a lot more of them, and they do that, and that's part of the fun of raising them. And they're very clean animals.
I wanted to ask about that.
They're very clean. And if they do mess, as we refer to it, they'll do it in their little cages, and it doesn't make any difference. And they dig a little hole for it also.
Is that what this one's doing here? Could we get a close-up of that?
No. No, this one's just trying to get away. That's his mate over there. That's the one they're trying to catch.
Well, look at that. They just caught it. That's... Our floor manager just told me they stepped on it.
That's a female. That's a squirrel, as we say. Those bright colors around the snout. Nose rings, we call them. They differentiate between them. And, of course, you just cover them up with this Nair guard and they won't breed.
They can't breathe?
No, they can't breed.
There's one crawling up my leg.
But seriously, Brad, Ken, we want them to breed as much as possible. And this guard is only used, of course, when you're away on vacation, you know, and it becomes inconvenient for them to...
Brad, now how could we... Let's go over to that demonstration.
Well, I'm going to show you how absolutely trouble-free these little animals are.
Back here.
If you have kids like I know I have, you'll want to watch this very carefully now.
We got a big close-up right there of the little...
If you just stay still here.
Yep.
Now, I'm going to put out this lighted cigarette on this chinchilla now. There. Now, you can see I'm just letting it burn there. It doesn't harm the coat at all.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah, it certainly is.
Well, how's it's still smoking there.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Well, how is this possible, Ken?
Well, Brad, this chinchilla is entirely synthetic.
That's fantastic.
And with these little fellas raised in your spare time in the playhouse or the garage or the slaves' quarters, you'll be making hay while the sun shines and at midnight, too, with mutant flu.
Thank you. Thank you, Brad. And you two little... What's his name?
Doesn't have a name. They're all the same.
Oh, well, thank you. Just a moment. We'll tell you the numbers to call.
Oh, man.
What the hell was that, Phil? What were you guys...
Wow.
And I say this advisedly. What were you guys smoking?
Well... That's an interesting question. Our pot dealer was Harrison Ford.
What? Hold on.
Pot dealer at the time was Harrison Ford.
Your pot dealer was Harrison Ford. Okay.
Yes, yeah. That was before Indiana Jones, of course. He was a carpenter and a dealer and a friend. yes, we would smoke during writing sessions. We were not stoned, at least I wasn't, during our radio appearances, because not in performance, because it would throw your timing off, all right? But basically, creatively, we would use psychedelics and marijuana, whatever they call them these days.
Gauge, I think. Reefer. I don't know.
Well, I don't mean that. Reefer, yeah. Right.
I don't know what the kids call it.
Roofer.
Mary
Roofer.
Jane? I don't know. Yeah.
Mary Jane, yes. She was a good friend of mine. Anyway, yeah, we would use them creatively to help stimulate us, along with the El Presidente Brandy. You were asking about the writing situation. We would basically get together at one of our homes, sit around a table, and start developing an idea. for like a record, okay? And then we would build, sometimes it was built on a character. I created the Ralph Spohsport character, the crazy used car salesman, because I came out here with a show called The Amorous Flea. It was a musical that I won a Theater World Award for in New York, that Paul Newman presented me with my Theater World Award. And well, we brought the show out to the Las Palmas Theater in L.A., and I, of course, didn't know how to drive. I was a New York boy. If you come out to L.A., you move the letters around, it spells legs on sale. You have to have a car to get anywhere. So I got an apartment near the theater and would walk, you know, from the apartment to the theater, from the theater to the apartment. And eventually, I spent a lot of time watching late night television. And this guy, Ralph Williams, was selling used cars every second of the day on this one particular channel. And I became obsessed with him. He looked like a little dwarf, a little mythical character. I have friends, Ralph Spohsport Motors, and I parodied him and wrote this particular piece. I performed it probably on the radio, and they latched onto it, and it became one of the characters that inspired us in our albums. I think it was How Can You Be in Two Places at Once When You're Not Anywhere at All, also known as the Marx-Lennon album, Groucho Marx and John Lennon, and had Nick Danger, Third Eye, on the second side, because we were going to do that as a radio serial. And the radio station that we were on changed management, so suddenly we showed up to do the first episode of Nick Danger, Third Eye, and there was nowhere to do it. This radio station was padlocked. So we said, what are we going to do with this? We said, well, at that time, records had two sides, okay? Side A and side B. And so we said, well, let's put it on the side B of How Can You Be? Okay, perfect. And so we did. And that's how Nick Danger got on that record and became really our most popular a piece, because people could relate to it.
Before we talk to Nick, you know, there is probably somewhere out there within radio range who, when you talk about Ralph Spoilsport, says, huh, what? You know, and this is the great thing about this, Phil. There are people listening right now to you who've never heard of the Firesign Theater and are being wildly entertained, right? So that is kind of a cool thing if you think about it. But why don't we play one of the classics? So this would be, I think, the end of side one, a short little excerpt. So,
okay, and then we should get back to Jeremy. I've been hogging the airwaves.
You know what? I'm going to
talk about this, Phil.
Yes. This is actually a Jeremy request, this song.
Oh,
so
good.
So this song, is that what it is? Well, it's a song of the soul. Anyway, without further ado.
It's definitely musical.
You know what I'm going to do? No. What you going to do, Nick? I'm going to turn in my badge.
Yeah, I'm going to burn my uniform.
Hiya, friends. Ralph Spohsport, owner and operator of the world's biggest dealership, west of Baalbek. As you know, we're overdosed again with all tastes and kilos. Let's just take a look at some of these fabulous lids. The LaGuardia report says this key should be capped for $10,500 in easy money sentences of a year to life and nobody done. Our complete price to you, including sticks and stems and seeds, wine soaked and sugar cured, completely clean for your smoking pleasure. Complete price. Only what the traffic will allow in unmarked bills delivered to me, Ralph Icebag, in a plain brown wrapper by a brown shoot square in the dead of night. Let's take a taste of this fabulous Yucatan Blue, scored to you from the sky blue waters of that beautiful Mexican Bay, and picked by naked little froggy native boys in their tight leather aprons running through the fields by the sea. Oh, and the sea. Crimson, sometimes like fire. And the glorious sunsets and the fig trees in the Alameda Gardens. Yes, yes. And all the queer little streets and pink and blue and yellow houses and the rose gardens and the jessamines and geraniums and cactuses and Gibraltar. As a boy, where I was a flower of the mountain. Yes, where I put the rose in my hair like the Andalusian girls used. Yes.
and how she kissed me under the Moorish wall. And I thought, well, as well him as another. And she asked me, would I? Yes, to say, yes, my mountain flower. And first I put my arms around him, yes, and drew her down to me so I could feel her breasts all perfumed, yes. And his heart was going like mad. And yes, I said, yes, I will. Yes, yes, yes.
Jeremy, you're the big-time Cornell literature professor. I'll ask you, what the hell's going on in that?
Well, there's a ton going on there. So a few things to notice. So first of all, Phil was talking about how the beginning of this side begins with his parody of Ralph Williams, who was a late night. He did television ads for his used car dealership on late night television. And he returns at the end of this extremely wild 30 minutes of radio, and he's now selling weed, right? And so you can hear, you get that persona again. And in the background, you can hear traffic in the, as a sort of a sound effect. But then, through this incredibly magisterial Phil Proctor performance, it turns into the last 100 lines of James Joyce's Ulysses. And as that's happening, the traffic turns into waves. And the other thing, which I think is really echt Firesign Theater, and we've already heard it on a few of the things that we've listened to, is that it's not only Phil's amazing performance as Ralph Spoilsport, who's, you know, also there's some fun gender play where, you know, he's speaking both, you know, he's speaking as Molly Bloom, so he's speaking in a female persona and a male persona. But the other three fire signs are you know, producing this ocean of yeses, which combine with the waves to create what I think is, you know, one of the most arresting and utopian album sides in the whole history of recording.
I would say, and the thing, Phil Proctor, it's you guys never ever dumbed anything down. It's so clear that you did wrote stuff that got you off, that worked on all the levels you could. You weren't worrying about will they get that. It strikes me that the four of you as writers were writing to the highest common denominator, and that would be you four for each other.
Yes, it's true. Yeah.
And this, if I can add, Phil, can I add to that for a moment? Because it seemed we were talking about radio, but then you were talking about, you know, the things that were that you realized were available to you working in a multi-track recording studio, but also working with the album format, knowing that people who own the albums could listen to them again and again.
That's right.
And so I'm wondering if you want to talk about just what it, how you changed the way in which you worked. If I can just put it this way, that it seems to me that you, another way of putting asking Eric's question is to say that you realized that you didn't need to worry about your listeners understanding everything at once, and you would always give them more than one thing to listen to.
That's right. Yeah, and the other aspect of it was our work was uncensored. We did not foresee that we would become celebrated enough in the culture that people would start to play our material on the radio, because at the time there was no stereo radio. There was no FM, and FM came in soon after we started producing our records. So basically, we were producing material for the home theater, for private listening, which is why we used some racy language, you know, which was the language of the street, of the people, right? And why we also did a lot of really politically incorrect material, you know. For instance, the American pageant, which is what part of How Can You Be in Two Places at Once, I think, it uses all of the derogatory names that were used to defile minorities, okay? And we made a song out of it, which basically was designed to take the power away from, you know, derogatory names for minorities.
Well, Lenny Bruce did that, too. You know, Bruce definitely.
Yeah, Bruce was a great influence.
I just have to do one thing, and as a professional radio guy, you'll understand. It's called a station ID. This is KSQD Santa Cruz, KSQT Prunedale. I'm here with Jeremy Braddock, author of an incredible book on the Firesign Theater, and Phil Proctor, a member of the Firesign Theater, and your humble narrator, Eric Nelson, who's trying to connect all these dots. And deadheads who are just tuning in now for the Grateful Dead Zone, there will be a short second set, Grateful Dead Zone, at 1 o'clock. But if you're a deadhead, it's time for all of you ladies and gentlemen, cats and kittens, foxes and coyotes, to become a firehead. And I think the I think the Venn diagram, Phil Proctor, between the Grateful Dead fans and the Firesign Theater is extensive enough. So I think we'll keep. Yeah.
I just learned that on the Dead 72 tour, they had two buses, and the one that the band traveled in was the Bozo bus.
Hey, right. Well, there was. You know, you've raised an interesting point, Jeremy. At the time that we were creating, we were given the opportunity to create our wild, crazy art. The record industry was just beginning to find its footing. And as a result, we kind of knew all of the other up-and-coming performers, you know? So we could, like, in a sense, hang out together. And I remember we did at certain times, and I did get to meet Bob Dylan, and I did get to meet Mick Jagger, and I did I even met John Lennon and gave him a Not Insane button,
which he wore at a Newtopia press conference.
I
just finished a film on when he and Yoko took over the Mike Douglas show back in 1972. And so I'm very tuned in to John Lennon 72, 73, 74. So I was going to ask you about that, Ringo.
Yeah, there was a kind of a kinship going on at that time. We all knew that we were part of a new media platform that, well, it wasn't new, mind you. You know, photograph recording had been around for a long time. But the opportunity to do an extended piece, the LP, the long playing 33 and a third record, you know, as opposed to the 78, which was a quick one, or the 45, which was a fast draw, you know, it gave us an opportunity to really tell a story, you know, and use all kinds of different the tools, music and sound effects and Foley and multiple characters, you know, and original songs and all of that. In a presentation. That was very unique. It was all because of a fellow named John McClure, who was one of the suits at Columbia. And after, I think, our first record, they were ready to drop us, you know. Our first record was Waiting for the Electrician or Someone Like Him. And by the way, the music on the side one of the, I think on both sides, was played by the Wrecking Crew, including Glenn Campbell. Glenn Campbell is on our first record.
And I didn't even mention him. Yeah. I mentioned all these people, you know, Bob Marley, Charles Manson, Brandon DeWilde, Jacques Tati, and I forgot to mention Glenn Campbell.
I have a question, actually, about that. Maybe we can get to after the station ID.
Well, we did a station ID, but I want to just say something right now, which is, and this is, I think of your work here when I hear this, is Schopenhauer. So, Jeremy, you're not the only egghead here in this conversation.
Ooh, good.
But he said that talent hits a target no one else can hit. Genius hits a target no one else can see.
Oh, that's very good.
and when I think of the Firesign
Theater, how can you miss?
When I think of the Firesign Theater, though, I think of the collective genius of you four guys. You know, A plus B plus C plus D, you got something unique.
Okay. I'm gonna explain that. You mentioned earlier, you called us the four or five crazy guys. All right. The fifth crazy guy was the combination of all of our minds
together, okay? And when we sat around the table and we wrote our material, one person, the basic premise of the motivation to do that was to make one another laugh, okay? That was the golden rule. If somebody said something that broke up somebody else or all of us or two of us, that would most likely become part of the story that we were going to tell, the show we were going to perform, the skit we were going to do on the radio, or the germ for a new record. And that fifth crazy guy was the surrendering of the ego and of holding on to who created the idea. Okay? Like Ralph Spoilsport became a part of the Firesign Theater ethos and various characters that were created along the way. Nick Danger. Yeah, Phil Austin was Nick Danger. I was, Ralph Spoilsport. But as part of the work, we all shared ownership of that character and whatever adventures those characters went on.
Well, to me, I'm going to say I think that's the deeper connection between you guys and the Beatles. I think that like there's
the hive
sense,
mind, the hive mind, and the Grateful Dead too. The sum of the parts, or Monty Python. And I know for a fact John Cleese was just in Santa Cruz last week, and their writing process was the same thing. Where if it made them all laugh, and it made them laugh, and it got them off, it was good to go. They never.
That's right.
And they didn't. They seemed. And I bet this is the case with you guys. Or tell me if it's not. When it came to roles, it was ever. Even though they were writers, it was who was best to do the role. They weren't possessive of airtime or all counting their lines. It was very democratic in a way. And I get the impression with the Fire Sign, it was an insane insane democracy where you guys. You serviced the material and you surfaced the thing and you put your, the other things behind. But that's a tough thing to pull. And the Beatles couldn't pull it off past 1970. Python, are all at odds with each other. You guys, though, seem to maintain you had your you got together, you broke up, you got back together. But you seem to maintain, a working relationship with one another over quite a long period of time.
Yeah, it was like a great marriage with no sex, okay? Which is, in some people's lives, a great marriage. Not mine, but some other people's. We were very generous that way. Excuse me, let me clear this, get this froggy little boy out of my throat. Much better. Now, all right, so anyway, whoever kind of grabbed a role, we would encourage it, okay? It wasn't like, no, Peter can do this much better than you can. If somebody felt that they wanted to embody a particular character, go for it. That's great. There were many more characters for us to choose from, And in general, I had another wonderful train of thought, and I think the train left the station.
We have to take a short break from our sponsor, and that'd be Jack Poet Volkswagen. So just 1 second here is our non-commercial radio station. Advertises a car dealership that's been out of business for about 50 years.
Very well, little lady. I guess that takes care of the Hickel gang. Soon the West will be safe for gentle, decent, God-fearing folks like you, Redwing, and your grandfather, Spotted Blanket. Come on, Bigfoot!
Gee, Grandpa, he gone before we had a chance to thank him. Who wrote that masked stranger?
That no mask, Redwig. That birth defect. Ohio Bigfoot! Away! Howdy, little beavers. This here's the Lone Wrangler again. After a hard day riding fences and chasing desperate in-laws, Tantric and I know what we like to sit down in. A heaping stack of Jack Poet Volkswagens, smothered in real Vermont brake fluid. Just that and a nice big cold glass of 30 weight is all we need to get Jack in the saddle again. That's Jack Poet, the Volkswagen of champions. 5944 North Figueroa in Highland. Try some tomorrow. All right, Tantric, let's cut them off at the pass.
Adina Freeway, Avenue 60.
Speaking of offensive stereotypes, but hey, what the hell?
And the thought I was going to say was, we also portrayed the women like the Pythons did,
although we had wives and girlfriends with great voices, you know, singing with us for the most part. And we performed, as Jeremy pointed out, to Phil Austin's wife, Anna Lee, and Dave Osmond's wife at the time, Tiny Osmond. They sang and performed with us at a couple of our stage presentations. But basically, just for the ease of the work we were doing and the fact that the four of us were creating everything, we would, you know, fearlessly become black people or American Indians or Chinese people or Japanese people or women or, you know, or Iranians, whatever it called for, because we didn't have time to go out and do a casting call and find somebody who was as funny as we were or who understood what lines they were supposed to say. You know, we were musicians creating different, playing different instruments. Well, and there's nothing wrong with that. Well, that's also, it's part of theater and it's part of comedy. You know, there's also nothing wrong with casting ethnically for roles. That's fine, too. They're all just different approaches to art, okay? And they should not be criticized as such, because art is, it creates its own rules. All right, or non-rules, for that matter. That's why it's called art.
It is interesting to think about how a group like Firesign would come together today, and I imagine you would want to have a group that would have women and people who are not only white.
Diversity. Well, sure. The thing is, the Venn diagram, though, of what was going on with the Firesign managed to capture. You had, you know, you understood the mechanics of classic radio because you all grew up on it. You had the political turmoil of the 60s and a completely culture being invented right in front of your eyes. You had the Lenny Bruces, the Ernie Kovacs, the comedic things to draw from. You had this incredible technology of the LP and 16 tracks in Dolby that you were allowed unlimited studio time due to your deal with Columbia to kind of play around
John
with
McClure.
It. And then, of course,
I didn't finish that story. Yeah, they were going to drop us, and John McClure signed us to a spoken arts contract, basically, which gave us unlimited studio time. We didn't have to pay for studio time. And that is why we were able to do what we did, because we could go in and try something out. You know, we could take material in there that we'd written laboriously, I might add, with not a few arguments. And we'd start playing it in the studio to lay it down on a record. And we would basically sometimes just throw it all out and improvise it right there on the spot.
Speaking of another 60s cultural warrior, Jean-Luc Godard, he wrote, "It's not where you take things from, it's where you take them to." And, you know, when I think of the Firesign, I think of that quote where or Orson Welles, I'm just on a roll here. "Don't give them what you think they want. Give them what they never thought was possible." Orson Welles.
Absolutely.
You know,
who I got to work with as well, by the way, in Henry Jaglom's first movie, A Safe Place, where I got to work with Tuesday Weld, Orson Welles, Gwen Welles, and Jack Nicholson. My first movie, major movie role.
That's Henry Jaglom's film, right? Yeah.
Henry also, you know, a very daring creator. You can love him, you can hate him, but it's his voice, you know, it's his vision of the world, and he has his own little studio, you know, he's able to do what he wants and create the kind of art that he sees in his head, and that's what the great opportunity Firesign Theater was given. Very unique opportunity. The only way it happens now is that an artist becomes so very successful that they can underwrite whatever material they wish to do. I think of my friend Al Yankovic, Weird Al, for instance, who has had such a great commercial success that he basically can underwrite his
his work.
Well,
and look at the incredibly inventive and funny and wonderful stuff that he comes up with.
Well, I got to interrupt you here because this is on the Amazon homepage for your book, Phil Proctor. And I said I was going to mention it a few times. Where's My Fortune Cookie? So this, if you go to Amazon to buy the book, which I encourage all listeners to do because it's a great, great book. This is what Weird Al Yankovic says on your book. Okay. I met Phil Proctor when I was just a small, feral child living in the woods on grubs and berries. He took me in, raised me as his own, and taught me how to be funny. The fact that my entire childhood was omitted from Phil's otherwise complete and compelling memoir is disconcerting, to say the least, but it's still a fascinating read, I guess. So, Weird Al, I did not know that you took him in and taught him to be funny, and he was living in the wood on grubs. But he would never. Weird Al would not lie now, would he?
No, and of course, Weird Al and I have Dr. Demento to thank for part of our careers as well. Barry Denton, he was basically, his works were played for the first time as parody records on the Dr. Demento show, and Barry also played a lot of Firesign Theater, you know. So thank you, Doctor, for helping us.
Jeremy, why don't we switch gears? I'm going to put this on you. You've pulled a couple of selections from Don't Crush That Dwarf, which we have what you called the converging courtroom scenes and Tire Biter's apartment, which. To kind of get into discuss that, because that was, you know, Grill Marcus, I think, once referred to it as the greatest record ever made. And Grill Marcus is quite or I loved another comment of Grill's. He said that Dwarf was the answer record to Catcher in the Rye.
Yeah, the ultimate answer record to Catcher in the Rye. I understand most of the things Grill says. That one I'm not sure I understand, but it's a great provocation.
So pick one. You're the VJ here. Remember those, or DJ?
Jeremy,
sure. What would you like to hear that we can we have converging courtroom scene and Tire Biter's apartment? So
So let's listen to Tire Biter's apartment. It's kind of a long clip, but it is really, really amazing. And so a couple of things that you're going to hear is that. You're going to hear the tail end of a long sequence that takes place in an evangelical church. I know, Phil, you've talked a lot about, you know, listening to the Hour of Power on the radio, and it's a time when both when there's evangelism both on the television and on the radio, but then you'll have this kind of amazing moment where the narrative shifts from that location to, like, the very sort of public resonant location to George Tirebiter's apartment. So anyone who's listening with headphones will hear how Phil's voice is passed through a filter, so it's going to become suddenly quite sort of thin and trebly, and will be panned, I think, from left to right. And and rather than being the sort of, you know, the dominant sound that you hear, it will suddenly appear to be just coming out of a television in George Tirebiter's apartment.
So ironically, religion is being shifted from left to right.
Yes, that's a great point.
So,
I don't know if we talked about the prophetic quality of what it was that we wrote.
Pathetic? Was that pathetic?
It was pathetic, but it was prophetic.
Oh, prophetic. Okay, sorry about that.
We were always thinking to ourselves, well, where is this going to lead society, this new influence, this through media?
Well, anyway, wait till we get to Bozos and we talk about AI, which you're personally responsible for, but we'll get to that in a second.
Well, the world is so full of artificial intelligence right now. I think that it's gone beyond prediction to disaster.
Let's play a little bit from, I'm sure, many listeners here, if you're a fan of the Firesign Theater, you've heard this, but I bet you've never heard it with Phil Proctor in the wings to talk about it afterwards. So let's go back to the end of it. Don't Crush That Dwarf, hand me the pliers.
I'm flapping my wings.
I'm hungry, safe, and sound, and hungry.
We're hungry!
Of course you're hungry. I'm hungry. We're all hungry, so let's eat.
Let's eat!
And he said the word, and we ate it. Hot dog! And what was the word?
Hot dog!
Hot dog, yes, dear friends. A mighty hot dog is our Lord. I'm not talking about hate. No, I'm talking about eight. Dinner at eight. Let's eat!
More sugar!
Ah, the glories of food. The communication of communion. Ethelman Rosenberg, I'm passing among you now with the plates. I want you to pick up those plates and eat of those condiments there. I want you to feel your body and your heart and your mind with the thoughts and realities of dear friend, Jesus said, let us be as children.
Some cookies.
And what do children do? They stop themselves from day to night. They eat. They fill themselves with reality.
Last three nourishing of cherries. Half a jar of mayonnaise. Oh, that's my last card. Laughing calf cheese. Oh, Jesus. Why is my mouth dry?
But I'm so hungry.
There's nothing to eat here.
Surrounded by a thin, thin, thin 16-millimeter shell. And inside, it's delicious.
I'll bet.
That's Arnie's whole beef halves we deliver. Thirsty?
That's me.
Wouldn't you like some of this old Filipino creamy coming in shorts and quarts?
Yeah.
And tubs of slaw.
Give me two.
Sorry, only one tub per family. That's whole beef halves we deliver everywhere. Offer not good after curfew in sectors R or M.
They never come up into the hills.
Yes. This is the Hour of the Wolf news. Big light in skies later to appear in east. Sonic booms scare minority groups in Sector B. And there's hamburger all over the highway in Mystic, Connecticut.
Good morning. Those are the headlines. Now the rumors behind the news. Here in a satellite report, bounce from Concept 3 is reporter Felix Paparazzi.
And General Ocelots, poppers, pineapples, palumbras, pizzas, Armenian gardens, tanks, juggernaut, no leviathan, mix, swell. This is George Tirebiter, Camden N 200R. I want to order pizza to go and no anchovies. What? Man, nobody will come up here at all. Okay, man, you've been talking a lot. Hand them over here. Oh, my God, you're still warm.
Thank you,
they're covered with... thank you, this is amazing.
Thank you. With your mouth full, I'll talk to you.
Okay, I'm eating.
While you eat, be assured, dear friends, that one of the two greatest guys in the universe, that great guy upstairs,
thank you.
As you are thanking me.
Oh, thank you. Oh, I can feel it.
Can you feel a change? Are you full? Don't you feel the changes, dear?
Oh, right on, Dale.
Are you changing?
I am changing
with the times, so let's meet him.
Support for KSQD comes from Santa Cruz Gives, a holiday giving campaign for 63 local nonprofits. Learn more at santacruzgives.org. Donations online or by mail through December 31st. Presented by Good Times with support from the Volunteer Center, the Community Foundation of Santa Cruz County, and local sponsors. Thank you, Santa Cruz Gives, for supporting community radio. K-Squid.
Talk about prescient. You actually had a underwriting thing for a radio station on that recording, Phil Proctor. I mean,
you know, we did?
Yeah. Mind boggles. I wouldn't make this up. This,
well, of course, what struck me in listening to that again, first of all, pardon me, David Osmond's wonderful performance as George LeRoy Tirebiter, who became a surrogate character, like an alter ego that he still portrays. And in the background, one of the news items was the merger of our government with a corporation.
Right.
Okay. And of course, the whole thing is about consumerism. All right. The religion of consumerism, which is what, for better or for worse, was one of the driving motors is of our society, with its, you know, its benefits and its problems.
So it's all your fault, basically. You thought of this stuff, you put it out there, and then all the people who bought your records created this dystopian hellhole that is America in 2024. Okay, Phil Proctor.
They gobbled up our records. Again, the whole thing about what we were doing was we were putting these things out. I thought of them as like being flying saucers. And whether they were identified or unidentified depended on the culture. You know, if people bought our records, they were supporting our art. They were supporting the next album. And that's kind of the way it should work, you know? I mean, it's the way it works in a consumer-oriented society. So even though we were often doing counterculture material, we were still part of the culture that was allowing us to do that, which is a paradox of America, if you will.
Well, Jeremy, I can detect your jaw being picked up off the floor after hearing that again. Getting back to the piece we just heard, do you have a question for Phil on that? Because it's Dwarf is such a central fire sign creation.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much to ask, but I guess maybe I'll ask a general question. So one of the things that I understand about this record is that Kent State happened while you were in the studio, and I think that there's a way of understanding like the end of the record as referring to it. But another thing that strikes me is that you get that moment where Tirebiter makes a phone call that corresponds to a phone call that Nick Danger makes on the previous record.
And that's
so
right.
And so one of the things that you're starting to do is to knit all of the albums together as being like part of one big story or one big world.
That's correct.
And one of the things that you know, the merger of the US government with TMZ Corporation and the fact that, you know, Tirebiter's in up in the hills in Sector R or N, is that there's just in the background is the suggestion that these records are no longer taking place in a democracy. And so I'm wondering if you can remember what led you to start to generate that world for these records.
Yeah, it was the growth of militarism in the country. You know, the Vietnamese War, the concept of utilizing military power in order to subjugate peoples towards the capitalistic way of life, basically. I mean, to be blunt about it, you know, a thin 16-millimeter shell, all of these references to militarism. And, of course, when you think about where we are now, Trump was basically, he's a con man who has sold himself to America. I mean, it's perfect.
It's all of our worst dreams come to fruition. You know, it took a while. Just like, you know, having Ralph Spoelsport selling dope was basically a way of saying, let's legalize marijuana. Okay, it took a little while, but we were asking for it and projecting it, putting it in the minds of people that it could be possible way back in the 60s and 70s. You know, it takes a long, long time for people to come to consciousness in the evolution of the evolutionary trials of this planet, because we are born as a tabula rasa. Everybody who gets, every child born on the planet has no recollection of what has happened before. And that's a big problem in terms of the evolutionary progress of the planet towards higher consciousness or spiritual enlightenment.
But Jeremy, you didn't grow up like I did, getting stoned in my rec room and playing Firesign records not too long after they were released.
You didn't see me in your rec room then?
You were a late adopter, and it got you to write your book, which I cannot plug enough, and that's why you're here. That's Firesign, The Electromagnetic History of Everything, is told on 9 comedy albums, and it's a fantastic book. And,
wonderful book. Amazing.
And we lured Phil Proctor of the Firesign Theater into coming on to help us annotate some of their work. I wanted to shift, and this is over to you, Jeremy. It's time for Bozos. And
yeah.
The thing that I know, and I got this from your book, is Eliza, the chatbot, that you, Phil Proctor, were exposed to this sort of what is now still scary cutting-edge technology somewhere back in 1970, and your interface with computers led to some of the basically what Bozos is. Can you give us a little sketch of that, like the your interaction with this proto chatbot Eliza?
You're asking Phil?
Jeremy.
Yeah, I'm asking, well, either one, whoever jumps in first. Phil, you were there, or Jeremy, do you want to contextualize it a bit, since you're a resident professor and official egghead?
Well, I'll tell you how I understand it.
That's your title, by the way, right? Isn't that said on your business card?
Yes, associate egghead. So Eliza was invented by a guy named Joseph Weizenbaum, who was a refugee from Nazi Germany. He came to Detroit when he was 13, went to Wayne State University, and had an early career, I guess, in, like, it wouldn't have been called Silicon Valley yet. Actually, this is a super interesting thing about, I think we're all bozos on this bus, is that it was released the year that that somebody gave Silicon Valley the name Silicon Valley. So it's very, very much of its era. So he did some work for a bank and some military work, and then got a job at MIT, at the artificial intelligence lab there, and developed the first bot called Eliza, which was in theory a sort of, you know, a rules-based conversation software, which you know, was not sound-based. You would access it through teletype, so it could be used in a number of different ways. But by far the most famous application was one called Doctor, in which you would interact with the computer as if it was a psychotherapist, and actually became hugely popular to Weizenbaum's later horror, because he later claimed that part of the reason that he wrote the Eliza Doctor program was to demystify the idea of artificial intelligence and the fantasy that computers could have,
and now,
could have sentience.
Enter Phil Proctor. So how did you interact with this thing, and how did it lead to?
Well, again, you know, if you lived through the 70s and you could remember it, you weren't there. Or you were, I can't remember what the quote is from Carl Gottlieb, but anyway, about. My memories of all of this are just that, they're memories. I remember going to a work fair, don't ask me why, and coming across this this program and looking at it and going, this is in keeping with this idea that we're working on of this artificial holographic government created pleasure fair, Disneyland, which basically was going to posit that science was going to be the answer to everything, as Jeremy has pointed out, based on the spirit of the 1933 World's Fair.
Yes, science finds, industry applies, man conforms. Science finds, industry applies, man conforms, which is the slogan of the 1933 fair.
Yes. Conformist society. Yes, absolutely. Don't be a nonconformist. And of course, we're still having the debate about science and reality, you know, how much we, you know, people who absolutely do not believe in science, and it becomes, you know, a religion and a way of life and a cult. And this created so many problems. The fragmentation that has been created is something that a fireside would have a lot of fun with if we were all still alive. Dave Osman and I are the only surviving members right now of the Fireside Theater, and we are working to release rare material through our wonderful archivist, Taylor Jessen, who you recognize, Jeremy, in your book. And basically, if you go to firesongtheater.com, you will see the new books that we're coming out with, collections of our plays, our screenplays, and records and recordings of performances and all that stuff. So it does continue. But so I stumble into this work fair with the idea of I'm going to do some research generally on the culture and what does this mean, what kind of jobs are available to people now. And I came across this program, and there was a big cardboard barrel that was filled with this printout. You know, it was that yellowish paper, orangish paper with perforations on the side that would be, you know, it was basically teletype. It was the way that radio stations got their bulletins and things, their news. Excuse me, I have to cough again, like I did last summer. And anyway, I started reading this stuff and going, oh boy, this is it. This is the communication between human and machine. And that's basically one of the basic premises of, I think, Royal Bozo's on this bus.
Why don't we play a clip? You annotated again, Jeremy. You have Clem and Dr. Memory 1 and Clem and Dr. Memory 2. So,
all right, I'm Clem. I play the part of Clem.
Yeah, so is Clem.
Pick a lane. Do you want to just go to clip 1 or clip 2?
Let's see. Yeah, why don't we do 1?
Okay, so let's just do an excerpt from this groundbreaking work where the Firesign Theater basically invented our current dystopian hellscape.
Okay. This is a flip-flop, Springhead.
Flip-flop?
Right. Now, I'm going to ask you a question that you won't be able to answer.
I'm not sure I understand you fully. Log out run off memory, A. The system is less energetic if domains of opposite direction alternate. NPM read MacNam, PNP read MacNam password, maximum output resource yield, illegal entry, try again.
Yes, we're going to try again. Open your gate, Doctor.
Sis, Bob.
That's right.
Dad, Bob, Mom, Dad.
Memory.
Direct readout. Dr. Memory.
Clem. Thank you. Now, Doctor, I'm speaking to you, Doctor.
Mm-hmm.
Something the leprechauns asked me when I was a sprout in Indiana has always puzzled me. Doctor, question. Evaluate. Why does the porridge bird lay his egg in the air?
Laugh, runaway makes no read. Unhappy MacNam, unhappy MacNam. Sistat uptime 9.
I have been awake for 9 hours, 2 minutes, 36 seconds.
At answer here,
I'm as tired of it as you are. And I hope that our children will come to love us again in some better world than this.
Yes.
Damn.
Thank you for question.
Okay,
exit
me,
center to Funway.
Yeah.
Well, there's a lot to unpack in that.
You really think so, Phil Proctor?
The backstory.
Yeah, you think there's a lot in there?
Okay, look, Clem, as we posited him, was a worker at this artificial government fair, which was basically created to use science to make people feel happy about the world that they were living in, okay? A kind of a classic science fiction approach. Clem had been a worker there, and he would have been fired. And when I talked to the computer who is going to use my persona to communicate with me, I hesitate. What is your name? Clem. Clem, I say. Welcome, Clem. So I became Clem. But Clem basically was there to get to the mainframe direct readout mainframe computer that runs the whole program for the whole artificial Disney World, okay? And I am a hacker, and I'm planting a virus in the computer which breaks it all down and breaks down the whole illusion, the holographic illusion of the park. That was what we were creating. Now, there was no such thing as hacker. There was no such thing as virus at the time that we did this album. But that's what we did.
Well, when you think of doing a lot of acid in Silicon Valley in the 70s, Steve Jobs comes to mind. And didn't one of you knuckleheads actually ran into him and he confessed that this album got into his head and influenced his work. Am I?
Yes. Yeah, I did. I did. One of the things I'm best known for to the audience out there is I'm the voice of Howard on the Rats cartoon. Okay. And I did voices for Disney and Pixar movies. Many, 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 many. Starting with Beauty and the Beast, right through Inside Out, and, you know, Finding Nemo and Monsters Incorporated and Toy Stories 1 and 2, you name it. Voices, voices, voices. And at one point, we were invited up for a cast and crew screening of A Bug's Life. David Osman plays like a major role in that piece. And I think I don't know if David was there for this evening, but I met Steve Jobs. And he said, I'm a big fan. I said, oh, great. And later on, when Taylor Jessen was doing research to send material to the Library of Congress, which purchased our archives for a nice sum, Taylor Jessen found a bunch of contact sheets of an appearance that we made in Berkeley at a record store, signing our albums. And there was this tall, dark-haired guy with shaggy hair and a goatee with his arms around us posing for pictures. It's Steve Jobs! Steve Jobs was a fan of ours! And he showed up in these pictures back in the 70s. So there, I meet him there, wonderful, great. I didn't remember this or know this, but then later on, when he invents the iPhone, I discover that he's put an Easter egg in there. And the Easter egg is, if I say, let's see, this is worker speaking, hello, which is the code I use to get into the computer, Siri would say back to me, hello, Clem, what service can I perform for you? LOL. Siri would say that for years.
until some fascist Apple engineer who didn't get it said, "Hey,
what's this? This is what does this mean?"
Yeah,
and dropped it.
Yeah.
Also, you could say, "Hey Siri, why does the porridge bird lay his egg in the air?" And Siri would say, "You can't shut me down that easily."
Well, let me ask. I have my phone here. Let me see what Siri says now. Siri.
Nothing. She won't say nothing.
Why does the porridge bird lay his egg in the air? Oh, Siri's getting back to us right now. Let's see. Is it coming up? No. No answer from Siri.
Nope. No, they removed both of those. But, of course, now that question.
Up. No, it says, I'm getting some... It's basically freaking Siri out right now. Siri is going about giving like 85 different responses. I think we just killed Siri. It's on you.
Well, that's very encouraging.
You did a serious thing. Well, you'll be held responsible for. Now that question, why does the porridge bird lay his egg in the air, was the question. I say it's from a leprechaun that I saw in Indiana. No, it wasn't me. It was a girlfriend of mine named Angel. And when she was growing up as a kid, she saw some leprechauns in her backyard. And one of the leprechauns said to her, "Why does the porridge bird lay his egg in the air?"
Wow.
And then laughed and ran away. That's why that phrase was used as a virus in the record.
So it's a true story.
Yeah.
That's great.
It's a question that can't be answered logically by, you know, zero and one. By a binary system, which is why the machine goes crazy.
Well, your fire sign, as we've been discussing for, realize, an hour and 45 minutes. We only have 15 minutes left. You speak about temporal displacement. The Earth has cooled considerably since we started this show, but the time has absolutely flown by. Kind of the later works,
Wait a minute. Maybe the Earth is heated up considerably while we were talking.
Well, we killed Siri, so I don't know. But into this with Jeremy. The album, the slightly later record, which I adore, was Everything You Know Is Wrong.
That was fun.
And Jeremy, your pick, your great underrated Fire Sign album is which one?
Well, I love them all, of course, but I do really love In the Next World, You're on Your Own.
But I want to play an excerpt from, because I'm at the controls, ha ha ha. I'm going to play something from Everything You Know Is Wrong, which everyone, it's just a great piece of production, and it's a great little self-contained thing, and it concerns aliens among us. We'll just play this thing.
And it was made into a movie. We made it into a short film. Columbia gave us $10,000 to make a promotional movie. So we took the soundtrack of Everything You Know Is Wrong, and we lip-synced to the soundtrack. And Alan Davio, who was not yet a member of the Cinematographers Union, he was our director of photography. He went on to do E.T.
That's right. He was a Spielberg Main Force So
yes,
he survived. His career survived working with you guys. Okay.
Yeah, and he was one of the first people to die of COVID.
Oh man,
Alan, the great Alan Davio.
Well, let's play.
But anyway,
no
lip
syncing here.
Into a movie.
But maybe we can multi-track this as we play it. But this is in the guise of an army training, a self-contained army training film oriented
army training
to
film.
How to deal with aliens.
Good.
Classified, ultra secret, Air Force generals only. Ten hut! At ease, men, take your seat.
This is General Curtis Goathart. If you are viewing this film, then we are under extraterrestrial attack. Beware. Your brain may no longer be the boss. If you are beginning to doubt what I am saying, you are probably hallucinating. Listen carefully.
What to do if an alien appears? One.
Drop under the seat of your plane and look away.
Two.
Avoid eye contact.
Three.
If there are no eyes, avoid all contact.
How to identify alleged sightings? One.
Pie plates, or as reflections in the atmosphere.
Two.
dry cleaning bags filled with marsh gas, or
three,
mass insanity.
How to inform your wife and others under your command.
Can I freshen that up for you?
She got that requisition.
Oh, she gets it. She gets it in the car.
Well, she's
not
allowed to have
it,
but
honey,
she's
related to the
honey.
People at the PX, though.
Well, General?
Honey and men, I have something awesome to reveal to you.
Well, go ahead, sir.
Go ahead.
Two flying saucers have just landed on my plate.
Well, turn away, sir. I'll eat them.
Good day.
Men, our greatest fear is realized. We are under attack from superior consciousness.
The eggs, sir?
They're only the beginning.
Well,
all right, men. Questions.
Sir?
Yes, Major?
Pass the syrup, General?
That's a good idea, Chuck. But syrup won't stop them.
But,
next.
Sir?
Colonel?
Are you nuts?
That is just exactly what they want you to believe.
The eggs, sir?
Let's just call them the phenomena.
Well, if I may respectfully submit, sir, I think you've got your phenomena scrambled, General.
What about my eggs, dear?
Honey, they're in everybody's eggs.
Good Lord.
You're fine, General. Another cup of coffee, sir. Settle down a bit.
Conclusion!
They think he is insane. Yet, he outranks them. His option, command.
What?
He seals off the area.
Two.
Secures the cooperation of local officials.
Three.
Obtains expert scientific assistance.
Four.
Evacuates all government employees.
Five.
And bombs aliens back to Stone.
End of film.
Can okay. I just say that I really love that that electronic bird noise during the breakfast sequence. Like you could have used an actual bird call, but instead you used that excruciating parody of a bird.
Like, the line, they think he's insane, but he's outranks them.
All right.
His option, command. I mean, that pretty much compresses all of Western civilization in three
and
lines.
And you know, fellas, right now, there's this whole kind of hint that we're beginning to recognize that we are being visited by extraterrestrials. All right, and remember, they're now calling them UAPs, unidentified aerial phenomena. Okay, right, and also they're in everybody's eggs, talking to his wife, because all of the experiments. That seem, you know, all of the abductions, or many of them, have had to do with the collection of sperm and eggs from human beings in order to create a new kind of hybrid being. At least, so the story goes.
And they are going to be great when they come around.
Oh gosh, I hope I'm alive to see the final revelation. I really am. But
I mean, one of the things that is so interesting, especially about this record, is that it has, like, on the one hand, it's a parody of, ufologists and New Age spirituality.
Yeah, coast to coast, AM coast to coast.
There's a seeker born every minute. Well, again, one of the great fire sign lines.
Born every minute.
There's a seeker born every minute.
But on the other hand, it does have a real following among. You know, real conspiratorial folks, and it's, you know, this album is the one that's sampled the most by the hip hop artists, and there's one, you know, sort of deeply paranoid record by a group in the 90s called the Presage Collective, and they both understand its humor, but in a sense, like they are deeply paranoid artists, and so it's interesting how how your work is available to both kinds of, can be read both ways, I guess. I'll put it
that's
that way.
That's good. Yeah, that's very interesting. Let me ask you a question, Jeremy. What kind, are you teaching a course on fire sign theater?
I've never done a whole course, although I've often thought, wow, what would that look like? And maybe I will, you know, including, you know, things like Bob and Ray, but then also, you know, it's so, just to get back to something we were talking about before, it's so interesting what was happening at KPFK, you know, like before you arrived, like there, you know, Austin was doing these Ionesco productions and you know, all did McBird. So there's a lot that you could do around you. But I've taught most of the records in some context. So I teach a class called, Podcast, Radio, Gramophone, Literary Technologies of Sound, where we begin with radio from the 30s and 40s. And then we do a bunch of LP stuff. And, and so it was, you know, when I first devised it was when I was starting to work on this book. So it was an opportunity to, you know, to learn some things that I really needed to know. But on the other hand, it was also an opportunity to teach fire sign theater.
I hate to do this, folks. I'm looking at that big clock. It is getting near time for our boot heels to collectively wander here. And I want to.
What's a clock?
Yeah, what's a clock? So, Jeremy Braddock, the book, Firing, the Electromagnetic History of Everything as Told on 9 Comedy Albums. And I have to confess, I came to it saying, oh, brother, you know, really? And it completely hooked me in. And the more esoteric and the more deep dive you got, the better. Plus, it's honestly funny.
And thank you for noticing.
And then Phil Proctor, author, not just a legend in his own mind, his own time and everything, author of Where's My Fortune Cookie, which there's so many great stories in there. And we basically didn't talk about almost any of them.
It's a series of psychic events that brought me to Fire Sign. And I'm having an amazing life on various kinds of higher consciousness levels, and I'm very grateful for it, and you'll get a kick out of it, I'm sure.
And you're not really allowed to listen to a rival community radio station like KPFK on Tuesdays, every Tuesday at 1 o'clock. I cannot recommend that, loyal K-Squid listeners, but if you happen to find yourself listening, streaming the Phil and Ted's Sexy Boomer Show, Phil Proctor and Ted Bonnet, that is on KPFK every Tuesday at 1 o'clock, and podcasts. You can get it on demand and just scroll through some of the guests. So if you want to see
We've been doing it for almost 3 years and talked to a lot of really interesting people.
And that's what's great and, you know, so thrilling and optimistic, Phil, is, you know, the work you've continued to do and that you are doing.
You.
I'm going to leave you a couple things, but a couple literary types. It sort of speaks to the fire scene. David Foster Wallace wrote, "I think what we need is seriously engaged art that can teach us again that we're smart." And a second codicil of this, "The writer's job is to give CPR to those elements of what's human and magical that still live and glow despite the time's darkness."
Hey, listen, I love that. Will you send me some of those quotes?
I will.
I write a blog called Planet Proctor, which I've been doing since 25 years. I don't know how much longer I can continue it because I have macular degeneration. It's getting harder for me to see and to do it. But planetproctor.com, you can visit it. And I love to use quotes. Interstitial quotes between all the pieces.
Some
of those quotes today I just think are wonderful.
I will be honored and delighted. So I'm going to leave you with my colleague Tony Russomano, who I host What a Week with every week, and we'll be back next week. But I had Tony read some excerpts from Gril Marcus's introduction to Marching to Shibboleth, another Fire Sign book. But he writes very well about your work, and I think we'll just leave this with Gril. Phil Proctor, thank you so much for joining us for two hours.
Thank you, Eric.
It's been a
thank you, Jeremy.
And
thank you, Phil.
Work.
And Jeremy, thank you again. And you know where to find those books. I'm not going to say the titles yet again, but you know where to find them. Jeremy Braddock, Phil Proctor, Google them. Anyway, this is Gril Marcus on the Fire Sign Theater.
Bye.
Bye.
Regardless of photos of Philip Austin, Peter Bergman, David Osman, and Philip Proctor that might or might not appear on album covers, there was absolutely no way to connect one or the hundreds of voices coming off the albums to a face. You recognized the voices. You'd heard them coming right at you or off to the side all your life, from childhood to last week. But the words the voices carried tossed all the old specters into the maelstrom of the times, from which they emerged, confused, angry, laughing, pleading for mercy. Working by instinct and guile, skill and determination, and most of all patience, the patience it took to layer one bit of dialogue over a track of an isolated sound effect, then keeping the process going within a single minute, or less than that, over the course of an entire LP, so that no matter how many times you might listen, you could never hear everything that was happening all at once, or maybe never, even after 100 or 1,000 listenings, hear everything that was happening at all. The Invisible Beatles responded with a non-stop breakneck restaging of the history that was unfolding before their eyes. In their work, the Firesign Theater meant to leech the power principle out of the reality of their times, the legitimacy principle, which says, in effect, who are you going to believe, me or your lying eyes? Me with my law books and handcuffs or those liars over there in the Firesign Theater? But they did so with such delirious craftsmanship that even when the times disappeared, the displacement effect did not disappear.